Macintosh Folklore Radio, written by Andy Hertzfeld and Company, and read by Derek Warren. Season's greetings from Mac Folklore Radio. A big thank you to everyone who emailed to welcome MFR back after a long absence. You can watch a special Christmas greeting video from MFR at www.macfolkloreradio.com/holiday2008. If you would like to show your support for MFR, I welcome donations on behalf of the Parkinson Society of British Columbia. Details are available at www.macfolkloreradio.com/donate. I hope everyone has a safe and happy holiday. 1984, September 1983. From the very beginning, Apple always had a flair for marketing. Mike Markkula believed that a fledgling venture needed to act like a successful company if it wanted to become one, at least in terms of external perception. Steve Jobs always insisted on the highest possible production values, even while Apple was operating in his parents' garage. The Apple II was featured in an expensive two-page spread in the September 1977 issue of Scientific American, even though Apple had less than 20 employees and minimal sales at the time. Apple's advertising agency was Chiat Day, founded by Jay Chiat in 1968. Jay was compulsively innovative, brash, and irreverent, much like an older version of Steve Jobs. The two of them hit it off when they were introduced in 1981, just before Chiat Day acquired Regis McKenna's advertising operations. Jay and his talented team, featuring creative director Lee Clow and star copywriter Steve Hayden, crafted Apple's first TV commercials, recruiting talk show host Dick Cavett as a spokesperson. They also created the campaign that launched the Lisa, including a TV commercial that starred Kevin Costner while he was still an unknown. Toward the end of 1982, art director Brent Thomas and Steve Hayden came up with the idea of doing an ad campaign based on the timely tagline, "Why 1984 won't be like 1984. Chiat Day shopped it around to a number of clients, including Apple, where it was proposed to be used for a print ad in the Wall Street Journal promoting the Apple II. Apple didn't go for it, and the idea was filed away until the spring of 1983, when they met with the Macintosh marketing team to start working on the launch. Steve Jobs wanted to launch the Macintosh with an inspiring commercial that was as revolutionary as the product itself. He loved the Orwellian tagline when it was presented, and he encouraged the Chiat Day team to pursue it. Steve Hayden and Brent Thomas put together an intriguing storyboard, envisioning a visually striking, highly symbolic miniature science fiction epic featuring a young female athlete who liberates the subjugated masses from totalitarian domination by throwing her sledgehammer to smash a huge screen displaying Big Brother. Macintosh marketing manager Mike Murray and Steve Jobs loved it, but they needed to get their new CEO, John Sculley's, approval for such a large expenditure. Sculley was a bit apprehensive. After all, the commercial hardly mentioned the Macintosh. But he gave his okay for an unprecedented production budget of over $750,000 to make the one-minute commercial. Chiat Day hired the best science fiction-oriented director they could find, Ridley Scott, whose previous movie, Blade Runner, possessed the visionary dystopian feel they were striving for. Ridley was based in London, so they decided to shoot it there at Shepperton Studios. Several Apple and Chiat Day executives, including Mike Murray and Steve Jobs, traveled to London for the week of filming. By the time the Apple folks arrived, Ridley's team had assembled a cast of almost 200. To play the oppressed, downtrodden, bald-headed workers, his people recruited dozens of authentic British skinheads, paying them $125 a day to participate. It was harder to cast the young heroine, since most of the models who tried out had trouble spinning with the heavy sledgehammer. Luckily, one named Anya Major was an accomplished discus thrower, and she could do it faultlessly, and she got the part. When he arrived at the studio, Mike Murray went looking for Jay Chiat, who was already supposed to have arrived. He found him lurking off to one side, seemingly hiding behind some scenery. Apparently, some of the skinheads were in a nasty mood, and they were looking for trouble during breaks in the filming, so Jay thought it was prudent to make sure he stayed out of their way. While the filming was taking place in London, I got a call from someone at Chai at Day asking if I could write an Apple II program in BASIC to flash impressive-looking numbers and graphs on the screen to be overlaid on the image of Big Brother. I spent an afternoon cooking something up, and I sent it off to them, although I was never sure if it was used or not. Lee Clow and Steve Hayden presented a rough cut of the commercial to the Apple team a few weeks later. Everyone was ecstatic. The commercial was classy, suspenseful, and enigmatic, and seemed certain to garner lots of attention. It was shown for the first time at Apple's 1983 annual sales conference in Honolulu in October. Steve preceded it with a clever rap, positioning Apple as the industry's last alternative to IBM to a rapturous reception, almost as apocalyptic as the commercial itself. The response was so great that Apple booked two expensive slots for 60 seconds and 30 seconds, costing over $1 million to show it during Super Bowl XVIII, which was just 2 days before the Mac's introduction. Mike Murray and Steve Jobs screened the commercial for Apple's board of directors in December to get final approval for the huge Super Bowl expenditure. To their surprise, every outside board member seemed to despise the commercial, with Mike Markola suggesting that Apple begin a hunt for a new ad agency. One of the board members remarked that it was the worst commercial he had ever seen. Steve and Mike were devastated. The chilling reception from the board compelled John Sculley to ask Chiat Day to sell back both time slots that they had purchased. But Jay Chiat was true to form and only sold off the 30-second slot, telling Apple that he wasn't able to get rid of the longer one at so late a date. Apple considered using the slot for a more conventional commercial, but in the end, decided to take a chance on the 1984 spot. The Mac team was told that the commercial would air early in the third quarter at the first commercial break after the second half kickoff. Burl and I had already seen the commercial many times, so we wanted to see a real audience's reaction to the commercial more than the commercial itself. We watched the Super Bowl at a sports bar near Stanford called The Oasis with some other Mac team friends. The game was boring, but the bar was packed, and the commercial looked great when it aired at the designated time. We thought we heard a small murmur in the bar after the commercial, but it was hard to tell if there was any significant reaction. That evening, we were surprised to see the commercial run again on the evening news shows. Apparently, it made such a big impression on lots of viewers that, coupled with the fact that it was only supposed to be run once, it became a news item itself, as well as increasing expectations for the upcoming launch. It ran dozens of times on news shows in the next couple of days, gathering Apple over $5 million worth of free publicity. A week after the Macintosh launch, Apple held its January board meeting. The Macintosh executive staff was invited to attend, not knowing what to expect. When the Mac people entered the room, everyone on the board rose and gave them a standing ovation, acknowledging that they were wrong about the commercial and congratulating the team for pulling off a fantastic launch. Chiat Day wanted the commercial to qualify for upcoming advertising awards, so they ran it once at 1 o'clock in the morning at KMVT, a small television station in Twin Falls, Idaho, on December 15, 1983. Sure enough, it won just about every possible award, including Best Commercial of the Decade. 20 years later, it is still considered one of the most memorable television commercials ever made.